I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Black Hole Cinema with Tony Black. And this is a resurgence for this podcast, actually, because it's been a while since Black Hole Cinema was around. People would have listened to it in the past and listened to me ramble on about cinema, but I've managed to corral one of my podcasting chums to help me every few weeks do a discussion about the UK box office top 10 and have a little bit of a skim down of all the films and see what we thought about them. So it's great to have Sean Wilson with me.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
Hello, Sean. I'm all right. I'm not too bad. You came on Black Hole Cinema when we did the composers, the original composers episodes, which I don't know if they're still online actually, but that was ages ago now. That was ages ago. And then we launched into our own Between the Notes podcast afterwards. So I don't know. I think this is technically the first time you've been on Black Hole Cinema just to talk films.
I'm diversifying my podcasting network. Yeah, because we rebooted our own show, didn't we? Yeah, from, like you say, from the composers into Between the Notes. Yeah, so yeah, happy to be here.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, and I thought, well, you know, we bounce off each other pretty well podcasting wise, and we both are big film people, and you know, that's something you work in and everything like that. So as well, doing the top 10, it makes a fair bit of sense. So this is a bit of a test run, really, and we're going to see how we go with it, and we're just going to count down the top 10. It's going to be a very simple format. Won't necessarily be massively long, but yeah, we're just going to count down the top 10 and talk about the films and talk about them in the context of the money they've earned. So I need some sort of jaunty music here, Sean, to begin the top 10. Like,
you probably need like the 20th Century Fox fanfare.
Yeah, maybe something like that. Underneath, yeah. I may well have edited that in at this point, but we'll see. Maybe all that, or, you know, that cheesy sort of, I think it was on like Top of the Pops or something, where he goes, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, oh, dun, yeah, yeah. Fond memories, yeah.
Yeah. Before I just start singing at people, let's start at number 10 then. And this is the box office total up to the 30th of May. So this doesn't include the, as we record, Wonder Woman has just hit cinemas. So this doesn't include Wonder Woman at this time. So because the data comes out more midweek and we're recording at the weekend. So this is up to the 30th of May. And number 10 is A Dog's Purpose, which has been on release 4 weeks. Have you seen this one, Sean?
I have seen it.
is that it? Is it like, yeah, let's not say anymore.
Very, very, very odd film, sort of, you know, resurrection tale that's meant to set tails wagging. Just the idea of one soul being reincarnated through several different dogs, all of whom have the voice of Josh Gad, the inner voice of Josh Gad, I should say. Very peculiar. I mean, especially when the dog is resurrected as a female Alsatian still speaking with the voice of Josh Gad. That's very confusing, that is. I didn't have a clue what was going on there.
It's a bit random. Yeah.
It's obviously holding on in there at the box office, so clearly people are going to see it.
Well, yeah, it's made 2.6 million. Obviously, this is UK box office figures, so the numbers are always going to be smaller for the UK as opposed to the US. But yeah, it's just about in there. It's just about sticking in there. So should people go and see it, Sean, or if they catch it later on Sky or whatever, or DVD?
Well, I mean, heck, if you like dogs, go and see it. Otherwise, I'd say, yeah, it's not really a big screen cinema experience. I mean, it's pretty inconsequential, I'll be honest, and the plot twists are very, very, very odd. I mean, I love dogs. And I kind of figure that any dog movie that fails to invest me in its dog characters has performed something quite extraordinary, really. I mean, it's not as bad as Marley and Me, which was, you know, about as fun as clearing up dog poop. It's not quite as bad as that, but it's not far off.
That needs to go on the poster, definitely. Not as shit as Marley and Me. Yeah. All right, number nine, The Red Turtle. First week of release, it's made just shy of £100,000. Obviously, it's gone in at number nine, so it's probably not going to stay in the top 10 very long. This is the new Studio Ghibli film, isn't it? I think you're a fan of this one, aren't you, Sean?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece of work. It's backed by Studio Ghibli. It's produced by them, although it's not strictly a Studio Ghibli movie. It's sort of produced through their auspices, and there are several of their most famous animators, like Isao Takahata, were on board as sort of production advisors. But it's actually made by Michael Dudok DeWitt, I believe his name is. It's a Belgian, French, Japanese co-production. It's a nature fable. It's one of the most beautiful animated films I've ever seen. It's heartrending and inspiring, and I'm so glad it's in the top 10. It's a limited release, so you're right, it probably will drop out of the top 10, but the fact that it's got in there during its first week is very heartening. With it being a limited release, yeah, I'd say anyone who can go and see it, because it's an astonishingly beautiful film.
Yeah, I've heard great things. I have heard great things, and you know, it's Studio Ghibli is one I haven't really done yet, because I'm not. I mean, I like animation, but I'm not the world's biggest animation fan. But I know I need to get on that. So this, you know, maybe this is a good start.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would recommend you go and see it. It's brilliant.
Brilliant. Wow. Okay. We may not get another brilliant on this top 10 this time around. So that, you know, that's saying something. So let's hope The Red Turtle sticks around. And number eight is a re-release of Moulin Rouge. Oddly enough, I didn't even know that had been re-released, strangely enough, which has made apparently it's been on release for 224 weeks. I don't quite know what that one. Should we skip over? We'll skip over that one. I think
everyone knows pretty much everything about Moulin Rouge, don't they? Really, I wasn't aware they'd re-released that. Actually, I don't remember seeing anything about it. But oh well.
No, me neither. It's strange. Strange that one's in there. Okay. Actually, just as a side point, Colossal, which came out recently, has just plummeted. It made like 271,000. It's been out 2 weeks. It's already at like 15. So it's like you'd imagine that might be around there, but Colossal seems to have bombed. Nobody really went to see it.
That's a real shame, because I did see it and I thought it was brilliant. I can understand why it hasn't generated a mass audience, because it's very, very weird, incredibly weird. But I love that weirdness. I thought it's genuinely audacious, strange movie, very, very ambitious. Sort of, you know, it's a fusion. It's a psychological monster movie, essentially, and I can't quite claim to have seen anything like it before. I can understand why it's alienated a mainstream audience. I mean, as I understand it, I think that got a fairly limited release as well, so it probably was never going to do all that well, even with Anne Hathaway in the central role. But yeah, it's a really interesting film. Again, I would recommend, if it's on near anybody, go and check it out if you're into like very off the wall quirky movies.
Yeah, it's what I've been hearing. Some people have said it's amazing, some people have said nah, it's not. But yeah, it's one I think I'll catch when it's on Now TV or whatever. Number seven then, The Boss Baby, which has made 27 million, been out 8 weeks, done pretty well this one. I've heard it's a bit odd, The Boss Baby.
Yeah, I've not seen it. I only watched the trailer, and I was a bit baffled by Alec Baldwin quoting Glengarry Glen Ross in the guise of a baby. I just don't. It seems like one of those. Well, I was going to say, it seems like one of those movies that doesn't know what its target audience is. Well, clearly it does, because it's made a lot of money. I can only assume that might have been parents taking children during Easter, during half term. It's obviously released at a very advantageous time of the year for those sorts of movies. Yeah, I'm not inspired to go and see it at all, and I like Alec Baldwin.
Apparently, the plot follows a baby who is a secret agent in the secret war between babies and puppies. Okay.
How do these things? I'd love to sit in on the pitch meetings for some of these movies. Like, how do these movies get pitched? Oh, it's just very, very odd.
Well, at least this one was based on something. It was based on a picture book, apparently, a 2010 picture book of the same name. So at least there was source material. Could you imagine coming up with that idea just off the cuff?
Yeah, the thing is, in a book form, I can see it working, but just in a film, it's just fraught with all these illogical sort of inconsistencies. I mean, just the idea of a baby talking with a grown-up voice. Well, for one thing, that's Look Who's Talking, isn't it? It's ripped off of that idea. It's also quite unappealing anyway, the idea of a baby talking with an adult's voice. For me, that doesn't strike me as a particularly witty or interesting idea. It's like, hey, look, there's a baby talking with an adult's voice. I'm like, yeah, where's the joke? but then maybe that's me.
I'd love to see you. You'd be a great executive there. Just like, they go, yeah, we got this great idea. There's a baby talking with a human voice. So what?
Where's the joke?
Where's the joke?
I'd cut that one down to size. But again, obviously, I'm completely on the back foot because it's made a lot of money. So clearly, it struck a chord with people.
It's made near enough 500 million. So it's got enough to get a sequel.
Yeah.
Which is coming in 2021, apparently. Boss Babe, so by then, it will be. Yeah, or it would be the toddler.
Yeah, exactly.
The boss toddler.
And then the 10th movie, wouldn't you know it, he's an adult talking with an adult voice.
He's just the boss.
Yeah, exactly.
The boss man. So, I think we can skip that. But number six then, Snatched. This is Goldie Hawn and Amy Schumer. It's second week of release. It's made $1.6 million. So it hasn't set the world alight, really, but it seems to have done okay. This just seems so. I mean, I don't. I suppose it's not aimed at me, really, but it just struck me as really. Oh, I don't care.
Well, you know what? I watched it and I actually quite enjoyed it. I mean, it is a flop, given that it's fronted by Amy Schumer, who made such a big splash a couple of years ago with Trainwreck. And given that it's Goldie Hawn's first movie since coming out of semi-retirement, apparently Amy Schumer persuaded her to do it. This is like Goldie Hawn's first movie in like 15 years or something. It came freighted with a degree of expectation and it hasn't lived up to it. It has bombed. I thought it was quite funny. It's a woman who's recently split from her boyfriend and her sort of neurotic stay-at-home mother go on holiday to Ecuador and they end up being kidnapped and blah, 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 blah. You know, it goes a bit Romancing the Stone at times. I thought it was quite funny. There are some good lines in it, particularly in the first half. It does trail off towards the end. But you know what? I kept consistently laughing all the way throughout. And the bit when they meet up with this adventurer bloke who you know, he's meant to be like this Indiana Jones style guy. And they realize really quickly that, oh, no, he's not that. And they go, how long have you been out here? And he goes, 3 years, weeks. So you find out that he's been out there for 3 weeks and the map he's got is actually just a bar map that's stolen from like the local restaurant. It's like little gags like that. Very simple things made me laugh. So yeah, I think people have taken against it. I thought it was all right. I'm not surprised it's flopped because it is pretty unremarkable.
Well, as well, I kind of think, I mean, nobody like... Not many people under the age of maybe, I don't know, our age is really going to know Goldie Hawn is anymore.
Exactly.
She barely makes any films. And Amy Schumer, I think, is an acquired taste. I mean, I think she's all right, really. I don't know her stuff massively well. But whenever I've seen her on screen, she's never made me want to go, oh, turn it off. But at the same time, she is a little bit of an acquired taste. So it's probably going to be one of those things. And I suppose, without wanting to sound too sexist, it's more pitched at a female audience, I would imagine, really.
Well, I mean, the thing is, she was in Trainwreck, and that had broad appeal. The thing is, with Trainwreck, it's like, when an actor makes it big, you're like, right, okay, are you gonna prove to me that you can diversify and do something else? And I don't, with Amy Schumer, she hasn't proved that she can do anything other than that Trainwreck thing. And indeed, since that movie came out, it's been a bit quiet on the movie front with her anyway. So now this new one comes out 2 years later, and people are like, why should I care? And you're quite right about Goldie Hawn as well, but I thought it was fine. Yeah, but it's obviously not going to trouble the box office anytime soon.
No. But well, maybe I'll catch it. Number five then, King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which has made second week of release. It's already at number five. It's made 3.8 million, which I suppose isn't bad, but then it's not particularly good either. But yeah, I mean, I was looking forward to this. I'll be honest, and I try not to let this happen, but I was swayed by terrible critical press. And I got to the point where it came out, and I was busy anyway. It's been a busy few months, but I just couldn't be arsed in the end. I was like, oh. Do you know what? If I always go by this ruling, I think, and I've probably said this to you before, Sean, but if more than about three critics are saying that something's bad, I tend to think they're probably right. And almost everyone said that this was bad. So I just thought, oh. What's the point? What was it? Was it as bad as everyone said?
Yes. I mean, it's basically Chaz and Arthur. That's what it is. It's just, you know, Guy Ritchie doing King Arthur, and you think Guy Ritchie's cheeky Cockney take on Sherlock Holmes, not so much the second, but the first one, worked really well. You can't apply that formula to this sort of mythological tale. This needs to be invested with a degree of gravitas and sweep. You can't do the, hey, what's up, King Arthur, all that. You can't do that with this material because it just doesn't work. It robs the material of its grandeur. It's really irritating. It's really visually boring. It's tanked massively. It's going to come as a massive write-off for Warner Brothers, apparently, internationally. It's going to lose them something like $175 million or something like that. It was an expensive film. It hasn't recouped its costs in America. It looks like it's going to do very, very badly over here. When indeed, you know, it's at number five, but I imagine people probably thought it was going to do better than that. Yeah, I thought it was just really, really boring. And the whole shuffling time frames thing as well, which is that it will withhold information from the audience about a key scene. So a key scene won't play out in its entirety, and later on it will go back to King Arthur. He's like, yeah, well, you may have noticed that there was this bloke over here, and there was that bloke with a nose, and there was that bloke with a finger. And it's just like that doesn't work with King Arthur. It worked with Sherlock Holmes with Robert Downey Jr. It doesn't work here. It's a disastrous mismatch of director and material.
And in a way, I mean, if you mentioned Sherlock Holmes, it was lucky that it got away with it there, because a lot of people could have gone, well, this isn't Sherlock Holmes. It's much more like Gypsy Banter kind of. But it does work. It does work really well with the Sherlock Holmes films. And I think it probably has something to do with the fact that it's got Robert Downey Jr. in it in a big way. But then Charlie Hunnam's just a bit boring, isn't he? I mean, there's nothing wrong with him necessarily as an actor, but I've never seen him do anything other than that sort of quietly brooding, sort of angry young man, and I'm a bit bored of it now. I mean, I loved Sons of Anarchy, and he was really good in that, but then he had good writing behind him. He had a good, yeah, you know, pulpy sort of television writing. I don't know, just all this, there's just very little in it that makes me want to go, oh, this looks good. This looks good fun. And as I said, I was looking forward to it conceptually because I quite like Guy Ritchie.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On the whole, you know, he makes some duff films, but most of the time he does all right. So I was just disappointed to hear so much of what kind of things you've just said, really.
Yeah, I mean, I'll stand up for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I thought The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was brilliant. Yeah. I know you would as well, but he wasn't the right person to put this sort of spin on this material. You know, the big crashing battle scenes, which are very, very post Lord of the Rings and now unfathomably dull. Yeah, I'm not surprised it's tanked because I don't really think it knows who it's aimed at, which is a shame.
It's aimed at Cockneys! Yeah. Hey! Yeah. And, you know, maybe though that they're all the people who went to see it, yeah, and paid the $3.8 million. all right, number four, Alien Covenant. $11.6 million, 3 weeks. It's done pretty well, and, you know, I liked it. I for what it was, I liked Alien Covenant. I thought it was a decent mix of the old kind of Alien style that Ridley Scott does. I love Prometheus, so I was happy to see all that Prometheus slightly up its own ass god stuff in there. And I enjoyed it. And you're not as big a fan though, are you, Sean?
I enjoyed bits of it. I mean, there's a lot to admire about it. It is a total mess, and I think that Ridley Scott is increasingly painting himself into a corner, which makes less and less sense, you know, the further this series goes on. It's a real shame because he's obviously a visual stylist, and indeed probably the reason why this is done so well is because it is visual grandiose cinema spectacle that demands people go and see it on the big screen. I mean, Ridley Scott is one of the few directors now who can command that sort of attention on the big screen, so it's not a surprise that it's done well at the box office. In terms of being a piece of storytelling, I think it's pretty disastrous. Despite all the ideas are interesting in it, they just it's the classic Morecambe and Wise thing. You know, I've got all the right ideas, they're just not necessarily in the right order. It's all over the place, and you know, you end up with more coming out with more questions than when you went in, and that's never really a good sign. You think, okay, as a piece of coherent storytelling, this hasn't worked. It'll be interesting to see how well it does over the next few weeks. It's clearly done well now, I think, because again, there is that inherent appeal, you know, familiarity with the Alien saga, but it threatens to make a hodgepodge of it. And you know, the closer we get to Alien now, the more trepidatious I'm going to get about it. So yeah, it's a mixed bag with me. It's a real mixed bag.
Well, I mean, it's unnecessary sequel, isn't it? I mean, all this, I mean, even to an extent Prometheus, although at least Prometheus was trying to sort of do new things, really. But this is, and especially any sequels that Ridley Scott, you know, he's talking about doing about 50 sequels to this before he dies, they're all just a bit pointless. They're all just a bit unnecessary, really. For as enjoyable as they are, in my eyes, at the same time, I'm thinking, well, we don't need this, do we? You know, Alien and Aliens are brilliant films. There's mixed sort of belief in terms of some of the other sequels. But, you know, it's funny because I've just yesterday been reading about how Neil Blomkamp has been coming out saying about how his Alien 5 sequel was torpedoed and he's dead. And, you know, it's heavily hinted that it's because Ridley Scott wants to keep hold of this universe himself and he's having this much fun doing all this prequel stuff. And I'm thinking, well, you know what? I'd rather see Alien 5, quite honestly. I really would.
Well, see, I would say that. But then apparently Neil Blomkamp's Alien 5 was going to write out what happened in Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection, which I think isn't fair, because whatever you think about those films, they are canon. They are part of that franchise. And I like Alien 3. I'll stand up for Alien 3. So in a way, I'm kind of glad that hasn't happened. But I think that, as far as I'm concerned, you know, no matter how much Ridley Scott tries to contort this series, and no matter how much he tries to add these grandiose philosophical spiritual elements to what was essentially a sci-fi horror franchise, I can quite easily shut myself off from these new movies and still regard Alien as the pinnacle. I mean, no matter how much he tries to connect the dots between this and Alien, I can switch my brain off from these movies. I can just ignore these new ones, because Alien will still always be up there as one of the most extraordinary films ever made. And in the end, Scott is only going to damage his own reputation in the eyes of people, I think, the more he does this. And I wrote a freelance feature about how very often Ridley Scott is at his best when he's making a movie that's based on a really good piece of source material, not necessarily just a good script, but an actual book that has a predefined structure to it. I wrote an article about this for Flickering Myth, and it's interesting to note how often that is actually the case. Like, you look at Blade Runner, The Duelists, The Martian. I mean, Alien had an original script, the first Alien, but it was a really good original script, really well written, and this isn't.
maybe you know, you put an idea in my head, Sean. Maybe an idea for an Alien prequel or sequel is get Morecambe and Wise in. You know, let's just time travel, get Morecambe. It'd be amazing. I'd love that. Number three, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2, obviously. 37 million, nearly 38 million over 5 weeks. So I think we can pretty much safely say this has been a monster hit. And much as I don't think it's on a par with the first film at all, I think it's great fun, and I'm really glad it's done well.
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah, you're right. It is a couple of pegs down, a couple of notches down from the original, but it's still great fun while you're watching it. And yeah, well, it's no surprise that it's done well, is it? Because really, it released at the end of April during the bank holiday, and it's a Marvel movie. It was always going to do well. It's a sort of mass popcorn entertainment that's actually really, it's a really agreeable film. It's a very likable film. And yeah, James Gunn's marshalling of all these wonderfully quirky off-the-wall characters, and again the use of the, as you call it, the dad rock soundtrack. Yeah.
Love the dad rock.
Dad rock, yeah. Against all the beautiful space vistas and the action, that still works gangbusters. The story for me isn't as interesting this time around. I mean, there is a problem in the second half in which Star-Lord is quite literally grounded and spends a lot of time walking around moaning about his father, you know, who is his father and things like that. And I'm kind of thinking, yeah, I get the point. I want more of the frivolity and the seemingly effortless quirkiness of the original, which came out of nowhere, and the first one came out of nowhere and absolutely bowled me over completely. Whereas this one, you can see they're straining to try and get that magic back again. They're trying harder to keep it loose and to keep it casual, whereas the first one was just loose and casual without even trying. But yeah, I'm glad it's done well, because say what you will about it, and it's very flawed, it is one of the most distinctive Marvel movies out there, just in terms of its, you know, utterly bonkers cast of characters.
Yeah, I'm always happy when Marvel films do well, because I much as, you know, there's pluses and negatives with cinematic universes, I've always enjoyed Marvel, and I think I always will. And it's great when Guardians, you know, like you say, is something a little bit different even within that sphere. So it's nice to see it do well, even if it isn't as good as the first film. But like, it was always gonna do well. It's so heavily promoted. It's fun. It's already embedded itself into pop culture. So good on it. Number two, Diary of a Wimpy Kid: The Long Haul. I think we've both been looking forward to this one, Sean. Oh, it's top of our list.
I will say, I'll stand up for the original Diary of a Wimpy Kid movies. I think they're really funny. I've not seen this one. Apparently, it's awful. Yeah. And it's got terrible reviews. I mean, I can only assume the reason why it's so high up at the UK box office is because of the half turn.
Yeah.
That can surely be the only reason for
it. Parents in it. Parents thinking, oh, let's just shut them up for 2 hours and yeah, stick them in a cinema. It's because it's made 1.5 million in a week, so yeah, I'm sure it'll do well, and it will probably be all these things. They tend to sort of linger around for weeks. Like this will probably still be on cinema showings in the 6 weeks holiday. Yeah, that's how it tends to work now. I mean, Beauty and the Beast is still on at various points over the half terms and things like that, and that's been out since March. February or whatever, and it's just,
I mean, that's done extraordinarily well, isn't it? Has that taken something like 50 to 60 million in this country? And that's astonishing. I mean, I think it's taken over a billion worldwide, hasn't it, which is astonishing. It's, I mean, Diary of a Wimpy Kid: The Long Haul isn't likely to do that.
It's going to take a billion just in the UK.
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm never going to watch it, really. It's until I'm a dad, then I'll probably watch all of them, and I'll probably do all these things, and I'll be able to talk at length for like 2 hours about every Diary of a Wimpy Kid film. But until then, no.
When it's clear that they've rebooted the Diary of a Wimpy Kid movie with new cast members, because obviously the original cast members are now too old to pass for Wimpy Kids, I think it will drop out of the box office quite quickly, I would have thought. The younger audience members will probably react with disgust.
Yeah, disgust. All right, number one then this week, inevitably, Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge, or Dead Men Tell No Tales, or, oh, I'm Captain Jack Sparrow, or whatever they're calling it these days. It's made 5.2 million in week one, so I think we can say this is going to romp home.
Yeah, depressing as that is.
This was one, I was supposed to be going on the Fail Critics podcast this Monday. I'd sort of tried to shoe-arm myself in so I could talk about Roger Moore dying, but in the end, I didn't go on it. Partly because I was busy, partly because I had no motivation. I had a whole weekend to not no motivation to go on Failed Critics. I had no motivation to go and watch Pirates. And I had no motivation whatsoever to go and watch this film. I mean, have you seen it?
Yeah, it's just dispiriting. There's no personality in it whatsoever. And that's a real shame, because the directors, Joachim Roening and Espen Sandberg, made Contiki a few years ago, which was a very interesting fact-based nautical adventure movie. And I thought, great, they've got some really talented directors behind this new Pirates movie. And they've got Javier Bardem as the villain, and nothing happens in it. It's literally got no personality whatsoever. It's just flat. It's becalmed. It's a movie that is completely becalmed, and it's a pirate movie. It's a pirate movie with supernatural overtones, with characters flying in left, right, you know, sword fights, cannons going off, big ships. And you think, how is it possible to make something boring like this? You know, pirate movies are some of the most fundamentally exciting things ever. You don't have to work very hard to make a pirate movie exciting. But the thing is, it gets so bogged down in the mythology of the wider Pirates universe. It becomes so much about all this irrelevant crap that you're just not interested in. And the way that it tries to link back to the earlier films, the first three, that is, the ones with Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley in them, it's like, I don't care. Just give me a pirate movie. Give me something that's exciting. And I said this, you responded to this on Twitter. Johnny Depp has turned into Frank Spencer from Some Mothers Do Have Him. That's what he sounds like. I mean, that's not Frank Spencer, but I don't know what that is. I mean, Ross Kemp.
Frank Spencer meets Phil Mitchell. It's
exactly.
but it's that whole thing that, like, Frank Spencer was funny, you know,
I'd say that's debatable.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, right, it depended on your point of view. I always found Frank Spencer funny, but that kind of buffoonery, he's very hit and miss. I love physical comedy. I love pratfalls, which is ironic, really, given I don't like the Pirates films. Because I should. Mm. In theory, I should, because I love physical comedy. It's the thing that makes me laugh the most. Hence why I loved Some Mothers Do Have Him, with its ridiculous stunts and him going, "Oh, Betty!" It cracks me up. But this, it just grates.
It is really grating. And Johnny Depp doesn't even look like he's invested in it anymore. There's a moment where Jack Sparrow climbs on top of a wall and sort of wobbles around a little bit and then falls face down in mud. And it is Frank Spencer, but it's just not funny. And it's really depressing. And not even he looks bothered about playing this character anymore. And it is a shame, because this is the role that basically transformed him from being a really interesting maverick indie actor into a big blockbuster star who could choose his own projects. And the more I think about it, the more I think I'm not sure if that's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
Really.
I much prefer, when I'm watching Johnny Depp, when it's something a bit odder or a bit stranger. It's like, so I watched The Ninth Gate, the Roman Polanski film.
I
love that film. Yeah. I think it's a really slow film, but I really like that film. And he couldn't be further away from Jack Sparrow. And that's like the late 90s, so it was before he did Pirates. And, you know, I miss seeing that Johnny Depp, or things like Secret Window, you know, which, they're not necessarily all amazing films, but there's things in them that I like, and there are much more muted kind of performances. And I think he's so far away from that now, with all these.
He can't go back to that now, because he's too big. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's made a load of money. It will continue to make a lot of money. Although, interestingly, it has flopped in America big time. Apparently, America's had its worst ever Memorial Day box office weekend since 1999, I think. Yeah. So that must have sent the Disney executives a memo, which is basically, people don't seem to care about this. Although, obviously, it's probably going to do very well on the international market, as a lot of domestic box office flops do now. They make their money internationally in places like China. But yeah, it's just very joyless. A damp squib.
Yeah. Or maybe even a damp squid in the case of Pirates. Squid, exactly. All right, well, that's the top 10. There are a couple that are definitely going to make a headway into this going into next week. You'll have Baywatch, which obviously came out the Monday after this weekend. So it was, obviously, with a film, you know, it's always the way. When they're nervous about how a film's going to do, they release it on a Monday, and then they track that as the following weekend's box office, so they can make an extra 5 days' money.
They basically cheated, and they're cheating, because it will be at number one with those cumulative 5 days from Monday to Friday.
Exactly, but it doesn't mean that it's a cheat. And obviously, Baywatch was one of the films that flopped on that Memorial Day weekend, so. We'll see. Wonder Woman will be in there as well, possibly at number two, given the Baywatch effect. But, you know, there's every chance, I think, Wonder Woman could then rise to number one a successive week, because I think that's going to do really well. So, yeah, we'll be back soon, hopefully, for more box office top 10. I think I've quite enjoyed this, Sean. I think we should do this every now and then.
It's really good fun. It's good recapping what's out, actually. It's nice to keep on top of. Up for doing it again.
Yeah, cool. We won't do it every week, obviously, because we'll be talking about the same films for quite a while. But every so often, every few weeks, I think we'll come together and we'll do a little breeze through the top 10, and maybe you can, you know, maybe find a couple of things that you wouldn't have normally gone to see, or things you might catch based on our discussions. So, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.